I think Michigan leads, someone's pointing out on Twitter, the nation in psychoactive mushrooms consumed per capita. Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Grook, and we just wrapped up a pretty high-energy second night of debates. After tonight, the first round of Democratic primary debates is officially over, so we're back again with a late-night podcast to discuss how the candidates did, what they discussed, and if we noticed any key trends throughout the evening. And here with me to do that, our editor-in-chief, Nate Silver. Hey, Nate, how's it going?
Good. Long evenings, but this is a more feisty debate than last night.
Indeed. Also with us is senior politics writer Claire Malone. How's it going, Claire?
It's good.
And managing editor Micah Cohen, how are you?
Very good, thank you.
We got the crew in full force tonight. Okay, let's begin with this. Claire, what was the headline of the evening?
Let me look this up because I literally just wrote this for our live blog like a few minutes ago. No, I think it's probably, and I think this is what I wrote, Harris and Biden tangle in racially charged generational battle.
So what, unpack that for us, for people who
sure, for people who weren't watching the debate tonight, Kamala Harris, I would say, really sort of stole the show, stole the momentum with this moment where she confronted Joe Biden about his record on busing way back when, and she basically said, "I was affected by your policies as a child," and it was the second time that she had sort of disagreed with Biden's policy vis-a-vis the Obama administration. You know, she her first point of disagreement was polite. And it was, I think, also pointed where she said, "I disagreed with the Obama administration on immigration, but the busing section was really emotional and pointed."
And part of that section was also her referencing Biden's segregationist comments.
Sorry, yes, that was part of it.
Which was a big story in recent weeks.
I think that headline is one of the few correct usages of the term racially charged, usually is used as a euphemism for racism, and in this case means that like there were undertones to the conversation of a black and Asian, we should say, women critiquing rather pointedly.
She said, "I don't think you're a racist," and then she...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's obviously the headline of the night. I think I'm more confident that like I it will help Harris, and I'm not totally sure how much it will hurt Biden, with the answers ranging from like, "This is the beginning of the end of his campaign," to he's still at 31% next week, because he has like had a little bit so far of kind of Trump-like ability to show that the voters who like Biden actually like him, right, and don't necessarily agree with people on Twitter about how he performed. I'll tell you, for me personally, this all gets tied in to like we have talked before about like, when does age become a liability for Biden and Sanders? And maybe the answer is like, at the debates.
Yeah.
For multiple reasons, right? Because number one, they're less nimble, and there are things that happen when you get older, especially over the age of 75, right? Where it's hard to be quite as nimble. If you kind of get off your talking point, it's hard to get back, frankly, on track, right? It's hard to admit fault, and Biden, I think, has to apologize for some things. I don't know. I thought it was pretty bad for Biden. I think that it's the first debate, so we don't know kind of quite how strong the reactions will be. Remember, Biden is not Hillary Clinton in the sense of someone who has 60% support going into the first debate. He has 30%, and 30% is kind of a lot, but not that much. And so if he's kind of holding on only to older, more conservative voters, you know, I would imagine there are a few Biden voters who will think, "Who is this Kamala Harris woman for attacking him?" Not many, but they're going to be some of them. What I do think also, I'll put it like this. If Biden is this bad in debates consistently, then it's hard to imagine him being the nominee.
I think that's a really good way to put it. But let's kind of check ourselves here a bit. Like, because I agree with everything you guys just said, where watching the debate, I felt like Harris is going to come out of this surging, Biden support is going to deteriorate, and everyone else, meh. But I don't know. Will the Harris moment really be that big?
So,
people like the media likes conflict. Maybe voters like it less.
I don't know that. I think Harris surges probably. I mean, she was leading. Google Analytics said, Google Trends said she was leading. She was the number one search term in the United States, right? So that, I think that says something. I don't necessarily think that it means
that hurts Biden.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And you saw, you know, his team tweeting stuff like, you know, Twitter versus voters, right? So that's their kind of line of, there's this reaction happening on Twitter, let's, you know.
Although there was some reporting that people in Biden's campaign were freaked out, although he also has one of those campaigns that seems to leak quite a bit.
So here's I think, the problem with the, like, oh, we care about actual voters, not Twitter. There's a grain of truth there, but not all Biden supporters are, like, older, much more moderate, even racially conservative, sort of like anti-PC voters. You remember that electability survey that was done by Avalanche, where they said, okay, ignore electability, you can just make someone president. A lot of Biden support went away with that question, which makes me think that if voters are watching him not look all that electable, then some of his support could go away.
And Harris looking more electable and showing a kind of a killer instinct.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I'm looking at a political headline or a Politico tweet that says, it's a picture of Kamala Harris pointing her hand on the debate stage and says, Kamala Harris dominated tonight, ripping into Joe Biden on race and delivering some of the most memorable moments of the debate. If that's the stuff that people are watching and reading for the next couple of days, that very sort of clear headline, whereas last night was a little bit more diffuse as far as the takeaways.
And she's someone who had favorability ratings that among voters who know her were as good as anyone else's. But now she's put herself at the center of the conversation, at least for the time being. I mean, I put it like this, right? I think you could get before, or let's say as of a week ago, I think Biden was an underdog relative to the field to win the nomination. But I don't really think there was a great debate about who was the most likely of the many candidates that could win. I think it was Biden. He had a pretty big lead in the polls. I think as of taping this at 11:31 p.m. on Thursday, June 27th, right, and having not had the benefit of seeing any polls yet, I think there's a debate about whether Harris or Biden is more likely to win the nomination, and I think there's a debate about whether Warren or Biden is more likely to win.
So why is it that up until now, Harris has been polling around, you know, 7%. Is it simply that the country hasn't seen her? Has she had other challenges in the campaign so far? And does one night of debate overcome those? Like, how do you go from saying Biden's at 31%, she's at 7%, now it's debatable who is likelier to win the nomination?
Because she hadn't really...
Biden and Sanders are national figures who have been known by the public for, well, you know, in Biden's case, several decades, yeah. And in Sanders' case, in a very high-profile way. Whereas, I mean, I think people forget this sometimes, but Kamala Harris was elected to the Senate in 2016.
Yeah.
She did not become a national figure. I mean, truly, she probably made her biggest breakthrough in some of the Trump hearings, right? So her campaign is quite, you know, I think she's attracted, like, talent, and I think it's quite well run. But it's probably a lot of the just getting her name out there.
Name ID, name recognition.
There's just a multiplier effect when she can have a multiracial coalition, right? Like, I thought Pete Buttigieg was pretty decent tonight, and maybe he'll pick up a couple of points, including from more moderate Biden voters who are like, oh, maybe got to look around a little bit. You know, although I guess his answer on the, I hate this term, by the way, the officer-involved shooting, the shooting that occurred by an officer in South Bend. I thought that was fairly effective, but I don't think Pete's going to have an easy time winning over black voters, and Harris has that multiplier because her coalition and the state she comes from, California, look more like the Democratic Party as a whole, right? And therefore, it's not just among the college-educated whites with whom she could gain ground. Does that mean she's going to do it overnight? I mean, not necessarily. We saw this week, actually, I think, was it three or four members of the Congressional Black Caucus endorsed Harris, which is kind of like a quiet rebuke to Biden in a tough week for Biden. And so, you know, look, I've always thought she has the broadest potential coalition. And I've always thought that, like, the three people with the clear path to the nomination are Biden, Warren, and Harris. They're just the most linear scripts, because you don't have to win the nomination in June. You don't even have to win the nomination in Iowa, right? But you need to, like, be in the running, and then at step one, and then have the ability to draw together a broader coalition later on. And those three, I think, have the most capability of doing that. I could see Bernie or Buttigieg winning Iowa. They're both, you know, pretty good Iowa/New Hampshire candidates, but can they then grow from there? I'm not as sure. Whereas Harris could be a strong second in Iowa, and then, you know, at 19% or something, then maybe, you know, And then South Carolina and Nevada are good for her. California is a good state for her. So there's just a lot of robustness to her path. And she doesn't have to, like, be on top of the polls tomorrow for her to be a co-front runner.
Claire, you brought up a Politico headline and sort of how the media was reacting to Kamala Harris so far. It was one big moment of the debate, but if the media latches onto that kind of one key moment and shapes the narrative around the debate from that one key moment, how much of a role does that play in how voters then go on to perceive the night and, you know, change their polling preferences accordingly?
Can I just to tee up Claire's answer, because I brought up all the headlines on the major sites. So Politico, in huge font, Kamala Harris breaks out. New York Times, Biden faces repeated attacks in Democratic debate. Washington Post, Harris-Biden clash on race stands out in debate second night. LA Times, seven takeaways from Democratic debate night two. Sparks from Biden.
SEO optimized.
Sparks from Biden and Harris. Honesty from Buttigieg. Wow, Buttigieg makes it in there. Des Moines Register, Biden faces toughest test of his campaign at the debate.
Yeah, I think this goes to a thing I've said before, a thing that, you know, academics have written about, which is that political campaigns are organized around these pseudo events like debates, right? So they create moments for us to talk about, and inevitably through headlines and through the cable news shows that people will watch, they'll form opinions. So those headlines matter quite a bit because, you know, you can have lots of voters who have lots of different issues that are the most important to them. So they might have found the guns part of the conversation the most compelling, right? They might have had a shooting in their community. So to him, that was the standout moment of the debate. But to people watching for that clashing storyline, something that already feeds into, you know, the past 10 days have been a series of racially charged controversies for Joe Biden, and that continued in this debate tonight, makes a huge effect. And so I think we are, and you know, you heard it all, us all in our initial, the first thing we said, right, when we were reacting to the debate, we all kind of pointed to that moment. And so it's, you know, we have to be aware of the human instinct to, all of us are paying attention to this really closely.
Yeah.
And it does, I mean, you know, debates are also almost power dominance exercises, and you know, because they are performances, and I think Harris did have quite a sort of like muscular performance.
I do think it's interesting that a lot of those headlines framed it around Biden, not Harris, because my initial instinct was to frame it around Harris and that she was the aggressor in that back and forth. The other thing though is like, just I'm like a little worried people are going to be listening to this and think like, isn't 538 the one who is supposed to be like tamping down overreactions to events like this? We've watched a lot of these debates, and this does feel, and you guys should disagree if you do, but this does feel like one of the cleanest narratives, which actually seems true, coming out of the debate.
In part because you know, five of the people were like, these people aren't going to be president.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, but Harris was, you know, Harris and Warren and maybe Mayor Pitt. Like, again, we talk a lot about, like, how you revert to some fundamental model. So, you know, we don't kind of know what the model is, right? But, like, you know, Harris is a candidate that maybe apart from having only been in the Senate for a couple of years, which was Attorney General of California before that, she has the profile, the type of candidate that would unite a party and win a nomination. Right. Warren, a slightly different type of candidate, but a candidate who is in sync with the mood of the party, is capable and well credentialed. I don't think that really describes like Mayor Pete as well. Maybe he is more of a different breed of candidate. But it wouldn't be surprising if like Harris and Warren, who number one are strong debaters, number two are well credentialed, number three have consistently had good favorability ratings, but not been a lot of people's first choice. It just wouldn't be that surprising if the result of the first couple of debates was that Harris and Warren are elevated into the true top tier.
I totally agree. I guess part of the point I'm making is that I would put Harris's performance tonight on another level than like Warren or Castro's performance last night. I thought they stood out last night, but I thought Harris had a better debate tonight than that.
If I can just say something. Yeah, I mean, I think that moment was obviously one that she practiced.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, she wanted that conflict to come to a head. I think it's notable to say that she was the only black person on that stage. Andrew Yang was the other person of color. But other than that, everyone else on that stage was white. I think, you know, Harris probably felt like that was her thing to go after Biden on. And you saw other people with sort of these, you know, trying to, I mean, Harris also had that line she had when everyone was cross-talking and she said, America doesn't want a food fight. They want to know how they're going to put food on the table. Also a very rehearsed line, but deployed. And she had this, I think, probably maybe more effective than other people. She kept on, you know, she would have these little road signs where she would say, let's make this issue relatable to the American people. And she would tell some sort of anecdote that involved like human characters. Whereas I think that you saw a lot of, I thought Michael Bennett was someone who actually was sharp, stood out pretty well, but talked more like he was talking on the floor of the U.S. Senate rather than talking to,
Whenever the top four candidates weren't speaking, I was like, I want one of the top four candidates to speak, except Williamson, who definitely had some entertaining exchanges. I felt bad for Gillibrand, who we talked on the pod last night about how it's like easier for men in our culture to interrupt.
What do you mean?
And I felt, yeah. And I felt bad for her because she is substantive. And another candidate who's kind of underperformed what her credentials might be. I think she might benefit actually from having been in the other debate where it is a weaker field and she can become the story for an evening. I don't know. But I do want to drive back to, do you guys think, because I wrote this in real time in the blog, you can see that, so I can't erase this. Do you guys think that Biden should have been more prepared? I guess it's kind of, the reason why I'm like a little being self-critical is because like it's such an easy thing to say, like, oh, we should have seen this coming. And also there is also a risk that like if someone is over-programmed, that they kind of default into one of the scripts they have. And that can also cause problems kind of most infamously with like Marco Rubio, where you're not actually being responsive. And before Biden had that big exchange with Harris, he had several questions where he was like non-responsive, right? Ducking the question. He's been doing politics for a long time. He sort of knows how to do that.
Well, it's hard to weigh preparation versus performance, right? Because, I mean, I watched his announcement speech where he was literally reading off of a teleprompter and had probably prepared that exact speech a bunch of times, but he was still stumbling over his words and not delivering it with like the kind of grace or forcefulness of some of the other strong debaters on the stage. So it's hard to say, like, is it a preparation issue or is it just, as you were talking about earlier, you know, older candidates may have more of a difficult time when they're these like young guns on the stage. I don't know. Is it fair to say that it's a preparation issue versus just a performance issue?
We're going to get ageist comments.
We are, but like, we were talking about this. It's what Nate said earlier. You know, Biden seemed and felt old up there, even in a way that I think Bernie didn't. Bernie felt a little crisper to me.
But Bernie at one point joined in and said, as a person of the same generation, yeah, and kind of, you know, tag teamed. I think that what Biden was probably trying to do was, I think I wrote this on the live blog, he probably to a certain extent talked to his team about how do you remain sort of affable and neutral. And actually, I was reminded of the Palin debate prep when people said, you know, his challenge there was to not look like he was bullying her, being a show off. Now, different, totally different scenario, but the whole idea being, was he going for a certain emotional affect on stage? Obviously, he got riled up at certain points. When the Senate came up, he got riled up a little bit. He got riled up about his record on busing. So, I mean, I don't quite know. I also think that Biden hasn't done as many out in front of their stump speech into big crowds events. He has been doing more. He just hasn't had as rigorous a schedule. And I think that probably does make a difference as far as like getting in your reps and like having moments and like ad-libbing.
I did find my, look, this is not the end of Biden's campaign,
no,
right? Like, let's be really clear.
Although even just saying that makes it sound almost like that's in the air.
But just the way we're talking, and I think the way the media will talk about this, it will seem so bad for Biden. And I think it was a bad night for him. But I want to be clear up front. This is not, I don't think this is like a death knell for Biden. But when you were watching tonight, did anybody else find themselves thinking like, oh, right, every time Biden has run for president, he hasn't done all that well?
He ran for vice president twice and won both those campaigns, which I think counts for something. I mean,
Wait, what?
That's a very weird view of how presidential elections work in America.
You mean like once he got picked as VP nominee? Yeah,
you're campaigning.
I think that's a much different role. I think
it felt
okay,
very.
But,
it felt,
yeah, we don't need to debate that.
I will say when Iraq came up, when his vote on Iraq came up, I did have this whole like, whoa, it's 2007 again, and like this is what the election's about. Like that was a striking
moment. I mean,
moment.
The sports part of my brain like kind of analogized it to like a quarterback who's getting sacked a lot, right? And kind of gets up and something looks a little off, right? And then I don't know. It's just like there was something about like,
and you're like, but he was a really good offensive lineman that one time. So why can't he play this position?
Because I think it's like he has lots of experience and he was able to fend off certain, you know, but like. We don't even know kind of what it's going to do to the polls. We have suppositions. Yes. As I think as you're saying earlier, I think we know when our suppositions are strong enough that our prior isn't zero. Right. Our prior is not that Harris will not gain any points on Biden. We could debate what it is, I suppose, right? I do think, by the way, Harris, like, I think her favorables will go way up. I think she also might have some unfavorables go up, right? I think there'll be some Biden voters who are like, you know, what is she doing? Why is she attacking our guy, right?
And a biracial woman attacking a white man, I'm sure will play into that, yes.
Yeah.
So on top of the dynamic between Biden and Harris, a lot happened tonight. You know, we had, somewhere near 100 minutes of conversation. Were there any other people who stood out or positions taken on the stage that stood out?
I thought Bernie was pretty mediocre and kind of got bailed out by the fact that, like, you know, I wrote before the debate that Bernie was the one who probably needed to attack Biden. I thought he got bailed out by being pretty mediocre and having someone else potentially injure Biden instead. But he also seemed a little bit monotonous. He didn't confront Biden really, except I think one aside about Iraq. And he's also someone where like Bernie is a perfectly capable debater. I don't think I've ever seen Bernie in all the debates he's been in ever do something that really got him in trouble. But he also isn't prone to that many standout moments. I think the same lines that he said so many times over the past 4 years are growing a little stale. I think that audience didn't help him. I don't know whether that's, you know, the DNC is doing or what, right? But like, it feels like he's got to pull out another pitch or two out of his arsenal, and he didn't show it tonight. And he was also a little bit stubborn about like not being willing to own up to his position on guns or whatever, right? Not being very dexterous.
I was surprised he didn't go after Biden more, yeah, because it was just another thing I thought that broke perfectly for Harris. Because if you're in Harris's position, which is you have all this potential, but you're not actually polling all that well. Like she's in what, the high single digits.
Well,
she
in a weird
double.
Way is like running on. I mean, I always thought the way for her to run was like I am tough and I'm running on the force of my persona, and it's actually kind of more in the electability camp of arguments than the policy camp of arguments. So I think her perfect position might be like, I'm going to be a little bit ambiguous on policy because the people who really want that stuff are going to vote for Warren anyway, or maybe Bernie, right? So I'm going to be a little bit ambiguous. You know, I'm pretty progressive and I have enough credentials as a progressive, right? Because I'm a, you know, black woman from California. You can't really get me too hard there, right? But like, I'm going to remain a little ambiguous so I can maybe shift around in the general election. She challenges both directly and indirectly Biden's electability argument, right? And I can imagine like her inspiring, like, I don't know if it's a good analogy to who she is exactly
from a past campaign.
Yeah, what's a good analogy? Like a campaign that was like very tactically,
well, until tonight it seemed like Marco Rubio.
The bad analogy is Rubio.
Why? Wait, I don't understand the Rubio just in, analogy.
Just check all the boxes but don't actually perform.
Yeah, and have, well, but she has been performing. Yeah. But just in the sense of having really broad appeal on paper. Stop. At that point, they're very similar, I think. Harris, though, has been performing. Rubio never kind of did perform. But can we come back to that? What I was going to say is what broke for Harris is by being the only candidate who really went after Biden in a memorable way, it has the effect of sort of putting them on the same level.
Yes, exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
And Biden is the front runner. So now all of a sudden, all the headlines are Biden, Harris, Biden, Harris, Biden, Harris. And that's what was surprising to me, like that other people didn't try that, that like that Bernie didn't try that or I don't know, Buttigieg or something.
I asked this in the live blog and I don't know if anyone answered it. But I was kind of, I also was caught by the fact that Sanders didn't attack Biden. And I wondered if it was sort of an analogy similar to the fact that Ted Cruz tried not to attack Trump too much during the 2016 primary at a certain point because he was kind of trying to get Trump's supporters, yeah. hopefully. And I wonder if there has anything to do with, like, well, Sanders wants to be careful about attacking Biden because he knows that they – because the two of them have the highest name recognition, maybe they share some stuff. Nate's giving me a look.
Well, I'm giving you a look because, like, Ted Cruz's campaign strategy didn't work very well.
Okay,
right?
But I'm saying it's a...
It might, like, be what they're thinking, though, yeah.
Okay, first of all, Occam's razor might be that Bernie is not trying to optimize his tactics to win the nomination and is just trying to get up there and say his Bernie stuff.
That explains because, like, a lot.
Because a lot of this stuff where he'll, like, go, like, you know, when he has people in his campaign being like, hey, last night was really, Bernie was the winner of the debate last night, right? Kind of stepping on this narrative about Warren. Like, that's probably not very smart in the long term. Say these are Bernie's ideas that were prevailing. It's, like, not the right way to put the argument, really. But I don't know. I mean, I don't think he necessarily had a plan up there. And maybe also he kind of thought, hey, look, I almost won last time, and now there's no more Hillary. But I haven't seen a lot of dexterity from his campaign. We've used that term a lot today.
Were there any key trends that we saw tonight? I know throughout the live blog we were tracking things like Trump mentions and how much speaking time each of the candidates got. Do those give us any indications about the kinds of arguments that people made or who was able to, like, dominate the stage?
The speaking time was pretty correlated with poll standing. So, like, Biden, Sanders, Harris, Buttigieg got the most speaking time. Everyone else, it was pretty slim pickings. I mean, Williamson, I think, like, didn't get a word in until
20-something minutes in. Yeah,
it was pretty amazing. The other thing that popped out to me is Gillibrand had the most mentions of Trump. And we saw more attacks on Trump tonight than we did on Wednesday night. And Gillibrand, I think, has just decided to go all in on anti-Trump, anti-Trump, anti-Trump. You know, she mentioned being the most anti-Trump senator on the stage tonight, which I think was an implicit reference to our Trump score. I thought in terms of speaking time, it was sort of normal, and is there anybody arguing that, like, oh no, actually all the candidates should get equal speaking time?
I don't think so. I think it also has a lot to do with how you can command the stage.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, I don't know how I feel about that on some level, though, because I think you saw this maybe a little bit more last night, where some of the guys who were jumping in, and guys is a purposeful term, they were you know, lower tier candidates who, I don't know, you might have preferred that the moderators kind of say, okay, we need to shut them up and, like, let's get one of the actual, like, upper to middle tier candidates to get more time. And I think that is a problem that exists. I do think it's bad that Marianne Williamson didn't talk for 25 minutes. That's not a good look.
No, if you're going to put her on the stage,
yeah. You should let her talk within the first, you know, whatever, 10 minutes as they're all getting their stuff out there in front. That seems a bit unjust.
To Claire's point, Warren got a lot of speaking time in night one, but less than you would expect based on where she stands in the polls relative to the other candidates.
But in part because she didn't get in the arguments last night. I mean, it was very much, it was like a back and forth of, like,
yeah.
Castro and O'Rourke, and then Booker was getting stuff in. Like, it just kind of felt, I don't know.
By the way, if you look at, like, word counts for each candidate, Jay Inslee in night one had, like, I think he must have said, like, two sentences the whole night, because his word count was, like, 1/8 of what the top people's were.
Does he talk slow? Maybe, I mean, it's a weird Washington accent. I can't quite do it.
I don't think it's that.
No, to me, it's actually that you have such a disparity in how much these candidates get to talk, I think is evidence that the format of these debates is flawed.
See, I think
the system is broken.
No,
I think you should have a JD debate, right? I think you should have that. And I think, like, if well, I know. I take that back. Maybe Castro broke out in the top tier.
Castro broke out. But okay. I've generally been in these arguments, Nate, arguing that it makes total sense for me for the DNC to have an overly inclusive debate to start, or even the first couple debates, and then start to winnow, right? But now I'm sort of maybe backtracking that a little bit, because if you're going to have Inslee on, if you're going to have Williamson on, but only let them get two sentences in edgewise, what's the point?
Yeah, so as we were talking a little bit about last night, we actually promoted this last night during our podcast, but we actually have data now about how the candidates did. So we can just update folks about, you know, Morning Consult's polling, our panel, how they reacted to last night and whether what it reflected data. What we kind of previewed on last night's debate, after last night's debate.
I'm sorry to say, I didn't listen to the post-debate podcast because I wasn't on it.
You listen to the podcast that you're already on?
I don't listen to the ones I'm on either. Actually, sometimes I do. Anyway, what?
I like to lull myself to sleep with the sound of my own
voice. My own voice, yeah. What did you guys suspect would happen on the podcast last night?
People generally said that a lot of candidates had strong nights, that Warren came out quite strong, and that Castro did well, that Beto O'Rourke did not do well, and that Booker did well.
Yeah, the polling's actually super-duper matched the Convention of Wisdom last night. I just think, you know, Biden is the one candidate whose supporters are not kind of well-represented in the instant reaction Twitter, cable news, podcast verse, and so I think we've learned to be a little cautious. Although in the polling last night, or after last night, Biden had already lost some ground, and he was actually, seemed like he was the primary source of votes for all these other candidates, who gained, in Warren's case, actually quite a few points. But the 1 or 2 points that Booker gained and Castro gained, you know, the quarter of a point that de Blasio gained, right? All those add up and have to come from somewhere, and he was a source of that. You know, we also did kind of have Morning Consult. They surveyed a lot of voters, and only some of them responded as of last night. And so it may have been people who felt strongly about their candidate's performance and may not be a representative sample. So as we collect more data from them, we'll keep refreshing that interactive, and it will get more accurate.
And we're also going to collect data on tonight as well, so we can check all of the points that we kind of honed in on tonight as well. I think it's time for us to wrap up. It's past midnight. But as we do close, we did talk a lot about Harris. We talked a good amount about Biden and Bernie as well. Were there any other moments on stage tonight? You mentioned Buttigieg kind of stood out in some ways.
I think that's the one, the his response to the shooting in South Bend, which I think he, as you said, Nate, I think he handled it perfectly fine.
Yeah, but I wonder, I mean, he's one who also seems to have like a little bit of a limited coalition, and so I wonder how he expands that.
Yeah.
But I thought he was good. And, you know, it is one of those nights where it feels a little bit like, boy, wasn't it obvious that like Kamala Harris would be a really good debater? I think we're on record as saying this at some point, right? That like debate should help Harris and like probably Mayor Pete to some extent, and there are vulnerable moments for Biden. So like on some macro level, like that the headline is Harris does really well in debates, Warren does really well, Pete does fine, Biden struggles, Bernie is meh. Like on a that seems like in some sense kind of fairly predictable, right?
Wait, can I add something provocative though? Those also seem like the people that have potentially their supporters overrepresented in media, right?
Yeah.
So you also run the risk of kind of the debates are a great opportunity for the media to put its spin on the way things are going in the election in a pretty significant way. And you could also see that reflected in those trends that you just described.
I mean, there was stuff like, so I rewatched the Beto-Castro exchange from last night. So I was trying to figure out, you know, Beto is not liked that much, I think, by not by journalists in a personal way, right? But he's a candidate who's become easy to dump on because he's underperforming high expectations. He's not that well qualified, but he's a little bit easy to kind of, and he got very favorable and flattering media coverage at first, which sometimes it's your own worst enemy because then you're able to have the media dump on the candidate the rest of the way out. And so remember that Vanity Fair profile, whatever else, right? I wonder if Beto were like better liked, so to speak, that people might have come to his defense a little bit more in that exchange with Castro, because Castro kind of interrupted him kind of halfway into his allotted 45 seconds and spoke over him in a way that I'm not sure. I'm not saying it's like impolite. I'm saying like it was an unusually aggressive interruption. And I can imagine if certain other candidates were interrupted in that way, that people were like, what the hell is this bullshit, right? How come Beto can't even have his 45 seconds, right? But because Beto is not that well, like, so look, some of what the debates serve is as a function for the party. And kind of the party meant in like kind of a political science way, like the party decides. And they would probably say that actually MSNBC and Pod Save America are kind of part of the Democratic Party in a way. Right. And so kind of in what about the neutral so-called media? That gets very mushy and complicated. That's a whole nother podcast, I think. Right. But like, but the debates are partly a artificial frame by which to adjudicate this conversation about, like, kind of how the party's thinking about candidates.
Can we close on these two Google Trends maps that are making the rounds?
Give it to us.
One, it's a map most searched Democratic candidates before the night two debate, and it's all Bernie with a few Biden states, particularly in the South. Then most searched Democratic candidates after the night two debate, and it's all Harris, and then few Buttigieg states in like the Upper Plains and kind of Mountain West, and then Michigan. And I bring this
represent
up for Michigan native Nate Silver, most searched candidate, Marianne Williamson.
Someone was saying like
Muck Michigan.
I think it's literally
I think Michigan leads. Someone was pointing out on Twitter the nation in psychoactive mushrooms consumed per capita.
I'm sorry, I apologize.
Based on the people from my high school who went to University of Michigan, that makes sense.
Oh wait,
so
wait.
What stood out
that
to me
was incorrect
is Michigan is like this lone island of whatever this color is, teal, representing Marianne Williamson in the sea of Kamala Harris yellow. But now that I look more closely at this, there's one other little spot of teal.
No, there's two.
Oh, there's two. Rhode Island and Hawaii.
Okay, not helping with the high drug consumption. I mean, come on.
Do you guys remember when, during one of the drafts, I chose Marianne Williamson and nobody in the audience even knew who she was?
Guys, let's go to the UP and just, like, drop some acid.
Nah,
call our friends in New Zealand.
I've had bad experiences with psychedelics.
Next time on the 538 Politics podcast, we're going to key in on Micah's bad experience with psychedelics. All right, well, that is definitely the place of the night for us to end. Thank you, Nate.
Thank you, Galen.
Thank you, Claire. Whatever that was.
Robot
we already
Nate.
Slipped Nate a tab.
Thank you, Claire.
Thank you.
And thank you, Micah.
Thank you.
And before we go, I want to give a plug for ABC News' daily podcast, Start Here. I suggested that our listeners go check it out last night. They're still down in Miami covering the debates for the 2 days. They're talking to ABC News' top reporters along with the candidates and campaigns to give you a snapshot of what the debates look like in about 10 minutes. So go check those out wherever you get your podcasts. My name is Galen Druk. Our intern is Jake Arlo.
Thank you, Jake.
You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with any questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or a review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you soon.